Welcome to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast number 30, The Transformative Power of Storytelling, a conversation with Elliot V. Kotek. I'm the producer, Jim Burke. Join us for a captivating conversation with Elliot Kotek, a Melbourne-born storyteller turned Los Angeles-based filmmaker, as we explore how storytelling and filmmaking are vital tools for creating a sustainable future. Elliot takes us on his journey from aspiring writer to purpose-driven filmmaker, tackling themes from social justice to environmental sustainability. Discover the role of creativity, purpose, and community in sparking change through stories that challenge and inspire. Elliot's work, including the Emmy-nominated and Cannes Lion-recognized films, question reality and encourage us to ponder our impact on the world. Elliot's recent projects like Black Girls and The Hidden Power of Purpose further showcase his mission to merge storytelling, technology, and social change. As a co-founder of the Not Impossible Foundation and Beyond Cinema magazine, Elliot's diverse portfolio, from Black Boys to Queen Mimi, highlights his commitment to amplifying underheard voices and using creativity for societal progress. With interviews from Oscar winners to Nobel laureates, Elliot's insights are invaluable for those fascinated by the power of film to transform. And now for our host, Dr. John Izu and Alain Gauthier.
Hi, I'm Dr. John Izu, and on behalf of my co-host, Alain Gauthier, and our producer, Jim Burke, I want to welcome you to this episode of the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, where we explore issues and ideas about the future of humanity and planet and how together we can create a positive way forward for both. Thank you for joining us. Alain, I'm excited about the conversation we're going to be having today with our guest, which is really about storytelling and the role that storytelling and filmmaking in particular, but also storytelling generally, has in terms of creating better way forward for humanity and planet. And I couldn't help but think of my daughter, my oldest daughter, Lena, a couple of years ago, advised me to see a film. Dad, you got to watch this film called What the Health. She said, it's on Netflix. And I said, okay, great. And it just so happened that my good friends, Ken and Cindy Camberg from San Diego, were there visiting with us. And so Janice and I said, well, why don't we watch this film tonight? They said, sure, we're game. And you got to understand, the backdrop is that we love visiting Ken and Cindy's house. They've been friends for almost 40 years now. And Cindy is an incredible cook and would make all kinds of wonderful dishes, healthy generally, but included all kinds of meats and fish and everything. And so What the Health is really about the plant-based diet in terms of its impact on the planet, on our health, and also on the impact on animal cruelty. Bottom line is, they watched the film with us and the next morning announced that they had at that very moment become vegans. Now, my wife, Janice, was instantly angry and depressed. She said, you're kidding me. It's like, I love visiting your house. I'm not going to come anymore. But we thought it would disappear. But now, I think 3+, 4+ years later, they have been vegan ever since. And I think of that as I go into this conversation today, because that one less than 2-hour film literally had two of my best friends after, you know, in their 60s, instantly make a change in their lifestyle that was good for them, but also happens to be good for the planet. So I think it's such a great and simple example of the power of storytelling and filmmaking in particular to impact the way forward. And that's why I'm really excited. It's something we haven't explored before on the way forward. And so I'm really excited to be in that conversation.
I'm excited too, John. I love films. I've been a film watcher from very early on. At school, we had a cine club, and when I was 10 or 12. So I've watched all sorts of, and I do believe like you that storytelling through film is very evocative and can make yourself think through. So What does it mean for me?
Yeah, exciting. And before we ask the first question, let's welcome Elliot Kotek into the Way Forward studio. Elliot, it's great to have you here today.
It's a pleasure to be with you. It's good to see you both. And I know most people will be listening by audio, but John, you look like a saint with that icon effect from classic paintings behind you with that map on the wall behind you.
Yeah, thank you. And Elliot and I know each other because we're a part of a group called the Purpose Collaborative, started by a colleague and friend, Carol Cohn. That's really a group of us from across the globe who are involved in purpose work and trying to drive purpose throughout the corporate world and in society generally. And I was saying to Elliot, I love he's wearing a New York Mets hat. And he said he wore that because I grew up in New York. But I said he chose the right hat because my grandmother was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. And when the Dodgers left New York, she remained a Dodger fan until she died 40 years later. And she always said, I'm no turncoat. And so I have a deep embedded dislike for the Yankees. So I said, it's a good thing you didn't wear a Yankee hat. And he said, because the Mets were okay because they weren't in town when the Dodgers left. But the good news is he said the other hat he has is a Dodgers hat because he's living in Los Angeles.
Well, I'll also suggest that the Mets hat is kind of regenerative because there's not a new one for the World Series wins each year. So you don't have to worry about that. Unfortunately, so you can keep the same hat from year after year. So, you know, yeah, it's got a lot going for it in that way, too, for the eco-conscious.
So let's get started, Alon.
Yes. So, Elliot, would you please tell us about what lit a fire for you to become a filmmaker?
Yeah, it's a loaded question, Alon. It's one that I can't really identify the moment too often, simply because it was a series of yeses that got me to this place. Yeses to things that I thought were cool, yeses to experiences, yeses to move halfway across the world to a different place. And I think it all kind of starts with some sort of charismatic figures in your world. And certainly as a young kid, I remember going to the movies with my grandfather. It was a Hoyts that was the chain that was nearby. I don't even know if it exists anymore in Australia. And we would go there and get our candies, our fantails and Jaffas and things that are different from what we have here in the US. And I loved that experience. And similarly with my parents, even though my mum was a school teacher, my dad was a chemist, we really did go to see a lot of theater. Even local theater that was held in church shift stage that was kind of semi-professional and really just took advantage of all these different cultural things that were available in Melbourne, Australia. I had that benefit growing up and was always a writer. So I think like no matter what else happened, no matter what else I pursued, I was always writing something. It was a need. You know, some people say like, oh, I really love to be a writer. I want to be a writer. But I think like a lot of times the people that find themselves doing it in some sort of professional way are the people who need to be a writer, right? Like that they have that muscle that it just doesn't feel quite right at the end of the day if they haven't flexed it, right? And so no matter what the medium, I think that was always true for me. And long story short, began writing screenplays, had some screenplays optioned, went to theater school in New York, thought it was going to be a short-term exercise and had good feedback on what I was up to. I got into journalism in a big way, and that led to the digital revolution of video instead of just print media and all the people I met along the journey and with whom I've started to collaborate and have continued to collaborate. We started making documentaries together, and then the world of branded content kind of appeared out of nowhere, and people were looking for more authentic storytelling and more direct communication and direct experiences and direct feels. And we were in the right place at the right time, or I was in the right place at the right time. So yeah, we can unpack that a little, I guess.
And you've done some incredible work since, a lot of which we're going to talk about today. But you and I are part of this group called the Purpose Collaborative, and you could, of course, have focused your filmmaking on anything, any topic. Talk to us a little bit about your focus on purpose and social good, for lack of a better broad term, where'd that come from?
Yeah, that's also like a really interesting thing for me. When I started writing screenplays, I was mostly writing comedies, and they didn't have that much social value other than being reflective of the societies that we lived in and commentary upon them. And then after theater school kind of broke me apart and put me back together again. And I began like writing about more serious issues. And what happened was I was doing a lot of interviews for the journalism. I was the editor-in-chief of a few different movie publications. And what I found was the conversations that I wanted to have and the conversations that seemed to actually do well and be evergreen at the time were the ones where we didn't just focus on the latest film that was coming out for that actor or director, that got more into the mentors that they'd had and the social causes that they backed and followed and committed themselves to. And the more I got into that evergreen side, I could see that, or I could feel rather, like how that lit up the person I was speaking with. And it always felt like a much more engaged conversation. And I found myself kind of addicted to finding that thing out from that person. And there was an energy exchange, really. You kind of fall in love with people when they're talking about their passions so close to your face, right? And there's this natural curiosity that most of us have. And to have that fulfilled with such positive content coming out of this person who you probably admire in the first place was really an addictive currency that was being exchanged. And so for me, it was like I just kept diving further into that and then started making these documentaries also because they were easier to make. So no big kind of grand gesture on my part, but like if you have your screenplays optioned, but you don't have the control to get it actually financed and made, then you start looking for things. If you have ambition and drive, you start looking for things that you can have control over. And because I was meeting a lot of documentary filmmakers at the time and talking with them about what their next projects were and what we can potentially collaborate on, it was just a natural evolution that we started to think, what can we do together? And the beauty of, digital cameras and the technology that was democratizing access to the tools to use to shoot these things meant that we could collaborate no matter what your peer, you have peers in your group, right? Like people who want to do the same things you want to do, but those tools gave you the ability to pursue it without a big budget or without a big dollar behind you. So we just started making stuff. So there was a guy, Frank Kelly in Ireland, who I'd met at a film festival, and he kept like recruiting me to help him on stuff. And we made a project called 140, which was the first ever user-generated feature film. There was 140 filmmakers contributing 140 seconds of footage from different locations around the world. I think we ended up having something like 27 countries, 5 continents contribute. And that was the first of its kind, the first use of that technology. Everyone signed up using Twitter, which at the time was being lambasted for destroying the way we communicate with each other in short formats. And we were like, okay, how do we use it to continue this great legacy of storytelling and actually use these obstructions, confinements, restrictions of the format to still get messages out there of unity and harmony and environment and family and comedy and all these other things that bind us and bond us internationally. And so we started with that, and then we moved on to other projects. But it became, again, like you have things that you can control. And so no matter where you are in your journey, there are people who want to kind of come along with you at that time who also have that drive or are waiting for a project to jump on board.
Something in common. When I was a young minister, that was my first career for 6 years. I used to love going visiting old people and listening to the story of their life. And I was kind of a journalist at heart. And there's something happens when you listen to people's story. And you, of course, you've done a great job of having people tell their story. But you hit on something really interesting, Elliot. There's really been an explosion around the role of documentaries. Isn't that true? Like, it seems like when I was growing up, documentaries were these esoteric things that, occasionally one came along, but they were really a, almost a very small part of the filmmaking genre. So two things. One is it true that documentaries have really exploded? But also the different vehicles and ways you can get that media out there have changed from where the theater and the networks were the only way you could do that.
Oh, absolutely. That's all true, right? A, the technology came that enabled everybody to be able to document whatever was going on around them, either creatively or in a documentary fashion. And that just exploded the amount of content being generated. That's number one, right? Number two is our world and social media demanded that. We started caring more about what was true and caring less about having things neatly packaged for us, especially by big companies and big media outlets. Like we wanted to, there was a demand for seeing the true stories and an ability to call out things that didn't feel true, that in such a direct way that hadn't happened before. And I think that also contributed to our desire to see things for real, as they really are, and be inspired by real people. And then YouTube, right, with people just following themselves, filming themselves on a day-to-day basis. And you've got a whole generation of people who just watch families go about their daily business. Now that, I don't know if reality television played into that, but obviously that did as well, right? The boom of reality television, whether it was Queer Eye for the Straight Guy or The Bachelor or Survivor, like all these things really just started to be massive franchises in the early 2000s, right? So it's a fairly new medium. And then, of course, the skill that came with documentary filmmaking, the personalities that started to replace investigative journalism in a lot of ways. When news sources and television stations weren't investing in their newsrooms to do these pieces, and when newspapers started to fade out a little from the everyday unit that had to be consumed by everyone, there needed to be something stepping into that space. And so documentaries also fulfilled that space of investigative journalism where some issue could be explored in depth. And so the creativity that started happening with the democratization of the tools, the influence of all these different kind of global phenomenon of cinema, it all contributed to this beautiful filmmaking that started to happen around documentaries, the different styles. You know, everything from Michael Moore, obviously, was huge. Morgan Spurlock with Super Size Me. But Michael Moore had a couple of films that made a lot of money at the box office. And that hadn't really happened with documentaries. And so that caused a lot of investment. Then similarly with the streaming services, a lot of traction around documentaries in certain genres we're finding out over time. There are certain genres that are doing better than others. And so those models are getting refined and the money is flowing into those more refined buckets. But there was a real boom for the last 15 years, 10 to 15 years of people making really high-end, beautiful, creative documentaries. And it's now kind of getting reined in a little bit. But certainly all those factors have contributed.
So, Elliot, you have been very purpose-focused in your activity, in your work as a filmmaker. What is your purpose?
Yeah, this is one. It took me making a film about purpose and knowing that no one else could make that, wanting to feel like I needed to own that space, right? So I made The Hidden Power of Purpose that was backed by AARP. And reading a book by Vic Strecker called Life on Purpose. Vic is a professor at the University of Michigan. And he had, in one of the chapters, he has a whole bullet point list of all these different traits and characteristics and things that you can pull together to form a purpose statement, so to speak. And so what I realized from that list when I picked out a couple is how important creativity is to me and how important community is. And so my purpose, in a succinct way, is to have impact from creativity and community. And that's really it. I mean, my company has a purpose statement, which is ideas plus empathy equals impact. We don't believe that one alone, having a great idea alone is not going to get you to impact if you're not applying it in the correct way and listening to the actual issue that you need to be solving. And similarly, empathy alone won't get you there either, because there's only so much hand-holding and understanding and trying to walk a mile in someone else's shoes that you can do. At some point, you also have to come up with some sort of actionable step to move you forward into impact. So I have formulas, you'll find this out, but for pretty much everything. So for work, it's ideas plus empathy equals impact. And then in my own sort of professional journey, it's more bigger with good people. I love what I do. I just want to do more and have more impact. And I only want to work with good people.
That's a good phrase, more, bigger, and good people. I love it. Elliot, you referenced one of your pieces of work, which the three of us have all seen, the hidden power of purpose that you did with AARP. Obviously, beautiful storytelling, a great people want to see a great example of your work, and they can watch that on Apple TV and Amazon, among others. Your work has quite an eclectic feel to it, from Black Boys about racism in the lives of Black men in America, to Little Miss Sumo about Japanese wrestlers in Japan, to Queen Mimi about a homeless woman who comes to live at a laundromat and the various connections that she makes. What's some of the common element that brings you to a project? And if there's one of those projects you want to talk about that, you know, specifically, that might be nice for our listeners.
Let me return the question to you. Did you find a common element across any of them?
Well, I think I just did now listening to you this morning, which is they're all really interesting stories, right? Whether it's Queen Mimi at the laundromat, or what seems like an oddity, at least to a Westerner, which is a female, you know, Japanese sumo wrestlers, or as a white man who has an African American, a Black son-in-law, you know, who's the beautiful spouse of my daughter. It wasn't until I started listening to him that I understood some of the experiences of Black men in America. So I see the common element is there's all very interesting stories that need to be told.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what happens is obviously there's some that I've generated and others that are generated by others, but for whom I either just have such a kinship that I want to see their work, like the filmmaker's work, succeed and make it out to the widest audience as possible. Or other times it's an issue that I feel a sense of urgency around, but acknowledge that maybe I'm not the right person to tell the story. So they come in myriad ways. And what I kind of do appreciate, if I can reflect on my own kind of world that I've created, is that I have the stuff that I direct and produce directly, the stuff like Hidden Power of Purpose, like the stuff I'm doing with brands that I really enjoy. And the brand work I do is impactful too. It's generally about their partnerships with nonprofits and how they're making the world better together, but oftentimes also about the innovative tools they're coming up with or the innovation or inspiration that they're creating in their environments. But oftentimes it's also just finding or being introduced to filmmakers who have a project that I just really want to assist in some way. Sometimes that's creatively, sometimes that's structurally, providing them with the contacts and connections that they need, the services like the, you know, cameras and post-production and music and composers and graphics designers. And sometimes it's coming up with impact strategies for them. And so, you know, I always thought that there were probably issues that I would go to first and go to most, but I found over time that I'm pretty issue agnostic and I'm pretty asset agnostic. It doesn't always have to be a feature documentary, but it really is like either there's a creative vision that I want to help out, or there's a cause that I just feel has such a degree of urgency around it that nothing will stop me from trying to help that crew get that message across. But yeah, it's been a joyride, so to speak.
So you are Australian, Elliot, and now you live in Los Angeles. So
both true.
We're wondering, what is it like to do filmmaking around social issues in a country like the US, which is hyper-polarized?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, there's never been quite a I can say that, but then people go back to history and show you other times when it was polarized. We just didn't have the same immediacy around the media that is coming at us on such a regular basis. And I think that that is part of it. It's just we have access to 24/7 new content. Not just access to content 24/7, but there's new content and people are screaming at us in order to be heard, in order to be seen, whether or not they believe in what they're even saying. And so that hyperpolarity, you've got to assume, is an extension of, you know, what we've created in terms of social media and media in general, which is that those who scream loudest get heard most. And that underneath it all, there has to be people who have a sense of responsibility, identity, community, and that if we can tell enough good stories and get them to the most number of people, then we can remind people how similar we all are, the commonalities between us, the inspiration, the joy that we can have in our shared successes. And I think that what happened is, you know, we spend so much time talking about the polarity that it becomes a truth, right? And so, and a lot of people who create documentaries, their joy is in creating the documentary, and they don't really concern themselves with who's going to see it, unfortunately. And maybe they just consider that to be outside of their control and they hope it's going to reach the most number of people, but is likely going to be consumed only by people who seek out documentaries. And so that's why we're asset agnostic, because we want to get a message out to the broadest number of people, but also to the people who need to hear it most, who may be deprived of those media opportunities or those social conversations that maybe someone else is having. And so sometimes that means having a 15-second YouTube pre-roll is the way to communicate that message, or having a 2-minute anthem video that is broadcast more like a commercial might be the way to get that message across or out there. And we're seeing more of it. Like when we watch the Super Bowl now, it's not just ads for products. It is storytelling. There are real lives being shared. And some of those ads are, like you're saying, John, or Jim was saying before the call, they can really touch us. They're really moving stories in terms of how people are using their phones and other products. Yeah, it might be an ad for a phone, but we're getting to meet real people and get reminded of how we're connected. So I just choose to remain optimistic about it all. I remember that one of the guys in the media, I think John Stewart, it was probably John Stewart back in the day when he was hosting his show, but he's like, look, we've got enough people screaming on the left and we've got enough people screaming on the right. We need the people in the middle to start screaming. We need people who are otherwise considered moderates who can listen to both sides of the story and come up with a path forward. We need them to start screaming. Now, it's antithetical to their behavior, to their current, you know, for someone who's a moderate to start screaming. But if that's the way that we get the attention, we just need to be sneaky good and get that message out as much as possible and keep sharing these messages and stories of common humanity.
Yeah, you know, Elliot, a couple of things occurred to me as you were talking. One is, what's the horse and what's the cart, right? Are we actually more polarized than we've ever been? Or is this kind of echo chamber that we've created and the search for attention and clicks and likes itself a driver of the polarization? And I love what you said about, you know, if we can get people, whether it's in short form, which may be easier for people to digest, because if I, as you said, have a certain view, am I going to go see a 2-hour documentary that has a different view? No, but I might listen to a 60-second story or a 5-minute story from someone that shows our common humanity, and it shows the power of humanizing people. And one more interesting thing, and then you chime in. I saw Arnold Schwarzenegger the other day, who, you know, love him or hate him, was a pretty moderate governor of California, right? And he's been a real moderating voice in the Republican Party. And I saw an interview with him on late night TV, and they said, do you think you could be elected in the Republican Party today? And I loved his answer. He said, well, all I can tell you is when I go speak somewhere, Republicans and Democrats both come up and tell me they like what I'm saying. He said, because I don't demonize people who have a different view than me. But I, a penny dropped for me. The problem is that people like John Kasich and Arnold Schwarzenegger aren't out there yelling, because the very nature of someone who's moderate and can entertain different point of views. But maybe those of us who consider ourselves in that camp, however we define it, need to be a lot more vocal. Not yelling, but a lot more vocal. So in some ways, you could argue it's the collapse of the middle that's destroyed America, you know, in terms of its politics, more than the extremes. The middle is silent, really, in many ways.
And maybe that's a bigger issue to explore, right? The collapse of the middle in terms of politics, but also the collapse of the middle in terms of economics in this country, right? It's the polarization of the economics of the country have really sharpened. And we did a, you know, I executive produced a film and helped with the impact campaign around it as well, called Unzipped, which was set in Venice Beach and is a look at the housing affordability crisis and how, as a society, we invested in home ownership by allowing people to have tax deductions for their mortgage payments, but we didn't invest in people who are renting in the same way. There are not those concessions and breaks and stuff for people who can't afford to come up with a deposit to buy a house. So that even just that small legislative opportunity on a tax code can cause a divergent path for two sets of people, the people who can somehow get enough together to start a home ownership journey and those who can't. And then, of course, the asset itself appreciates in such a huge way, or has done for the last however many years consistently. And so you're creating some sort of legacy that you can pass on to another generation in the form of a house, which gives that next generation the ability to start from one level higher, because they're not worried about the security of having a home over their heads or a roof over their heads. So it's really a game changer. Those sorts of small decisions at a policy level are creating these rifts, right? These chasms or chasms. And those things are really hard to make up over time. They're only going to become more disparate, more polarizing. And you're creating a sense of desperation in one set of people and a sense of entitlement in another, for want of a better word, right? And so, or opportunity or security in another group. So I think the collapse of the middle, there might be more to unpack there.
That's so true. And Joseph Campbell, the well-known mythologist, said that once, that we are in the middle between two stories. We are between two stories. So I'm wondering, we are wondering, given your own experience, what is the new story that is trying to emerge at this time?
Yeah, I also, whenever someone talks about Joseph Campbell, I always love these ideas of shadows and mentor figures. And so I'm always curious, even for you, like who those people have been, who was that mentor figure, whether it was a parent, a charismatic teacher, that kind of set you on this path to want to explore these issues. So if I can turn that to you as well, I would love to hear a little bit about that if you haven't addressed it too often.
That's very true. The shadow part is the unknown part, in a way, that we are something we don't want to look at. And that, to do that, requires going out of one comfort zone, because it could be challenging to go into that, into this depth. I was born in the eastern part of France, and which is a war-torn country, a part of the country for centuries. And the fact that my father, for instance, was both in the resistance, but also was the manager of a local textile company. And he had to lead a double life in a way. And some people actually were confused by that, and accused him also of all sorts of things. So I have been more recently involved in that, looking what are some of the shadows in my own family that I have not necessarily addressed and that are still reverberating on my own experience at this time. That's what I can say from a personal perspective.
Yeah, and I was thinking to myself, the first person that came to mind for me, you know, Campbell talks a lot about, and Campbell had a big impact on me as a young person, but you know, talk about the hero's journey. And I was thinking of I grew up, you know, in New York City during the height of the civil rights movement in the Vietnam War. And our minister, Bob Kelly, had been the first white minister of an all-black church in Harlem before, which tells you something about him, before he came to us when I was in junior high school. And it was a pretty conservative Presbyterian church in Staten Island, New York. And yet he gave these riveting sermons about the civil rights movement and about the war, and just his courage to face the shadow that was in the congregation. And he wasn't always popular. So he really showed me as a very young person how it takes courage to lead and to lean into that, even when it isn't popular. For me, he was one of those people that, you know, I saw the hero's journey in him. It inspired me to want to go and do likewise, to use a religious analogy.
Yeah, amazing. I think to try and answer the question in terms of what stories want to emerge, there are these kinds of social returns to a place of calm. I think people don't want to be stressed anymore. Like everything, all this screaming, all this polarity, what it does after time is it either makes people want to act to vent that frustration. It has to reach that level, unfortunately, or it reaches a level where people switch off or disengage because it's too overwhelming. So hopefully, at least we can get to a place of tolerance. I think like my goal through a lot of this, and I think like consistent in my writing since the beginning of when I can remember writing, is to somehow move us to a path where we're less ignorant or willfully ignorant of each other, and to move to a place where there's just more tolerance of each other. I think a lot of people preach love, and that is awesome, but there are steps along the path to love that need to come first. And one is just an acceptance of the presence of each other. And so if we can even just tolerate being near each other as a first measure, then maybe we can learn a little bit more about each other because we're a little less set up like fortresses and a little less scared, a little less fearful. And then with that education comes a bit more understanding. And maybe with that understanding, that can lead to some sort of affection or appreciation, which then leads to love. But if I can just continue to put stuff out there or help other stuff get out there that gets us to a point of tolerance, I think that would be a massive win.
And in that way, storytelling is a way, isn't it, of, you know, I think of, you know, I haven't had the privilege yet to see the film Black Boys, which won a lot of awards. But I'm thinking to myself, a lot of white Americans would never get to sit and hear the story of the lives of particularly men, black men in America. But through storytelling, we can sit beside in a safe way and not have to worry about what our nonverbal may be saying as we're listening. So I think in that way, filmmaking can help us sit beside, can it? People we otherwise wouldn't be sitting beside.
Oh, and sports too, right? I mean, we're right in the midst as we tape this of the end of the football season, the culmination of these stories and the passion that people have for the stories of these athletes who they admire and respect is also incredible and so powerful. The reality is that there are very few mediums that appeal to a majority of our dominant senses like film. It can depict an issue, reflect a reality. It can travel us to times past, present, future. It can make us feel a complete spectrum of emotions. And so then what we do with that when we have those feels, that's the stuff that often gets left undirected, uncalled to a specific action. I would love it if more filmmakers thought of closing that loop for us when they've got us raw and feeling and engaged. And so in commerce, we can do it. In commercials, in branded content, we can have a call to action. We can direct people to a certain place. In some of our films, we've started to use some tools like a QR code at the end of the film or even, you know, websites, whatever. But to direct people to find out more things that they can do and engage on five different levels, whether it's just a simple act through to a bigger commitment of time. And so film has that power to get us to a point where we're in a heightened, more aware state. We just need to also follow through and let people know what then to do with that feeling.
I'm curious, Elliot, are you finding it's more of that where, you know, there's a call to action as a part of that storytelling? Any sense of whether people are responding and taking up on that? Do you have, even if you don't have any hard measures of it, what's your sense?
Yeah, my sense is that there is more engagement. I think that the YouTubers get it right in that regard. The number of engagements they get on their videos and the way that people respond, and that some people use that for good, like Mr. Beast being the obvious example of someone whose channel is really about delivering impact on scale. And it's really impressive to watch. And then when you're at, it's weird, when you're in these worlds and you focus your attention on all the good things that you can do and your peers can do, and you start seeing it more and more, you see incredible campaigns, whether it's around the Barbie movie or whether it's around energy that people are interested in because of the Oppenheimer movie, or going back to the time of, you know, when Philadelphia and Tom Hanks, when that movie came out and was such an important movie for its time. I think like it's an interesting thing, but when you've got the blinkers on and you're involved in the work, you feel like everything is solvable and that the world is good. And when you're in these meetings with Carol Cohn and the Purpose Collaborative, we've got it. There's enough innovative people doing innovative stuff and coming up with really cool projects and programs. And it's filled with collaboration and good intentions. And you just feel like, yes, we've got it. When you're at an innovation thought leadership summit, like a South by Southwest or a Fast Company or something else, and you're like, look at all these innovative people. We've got it. The answers are there. This is doable. And then you get to your hotel somewhere and they've got the local news on, whatever it is, whether it's CNN, MSNBC, or Fox, and you see the mess that they are broadcasting, and no one's immune from it. I'm not calling out any specific network, but like they all play this game of heightened tensions. And you think, oh man, I hope the majority of people aren't consuming this and can consume more of what we're seeing and what we're doing at these other places and within these groups. So I think the power of networks is going to become more and more important to get us into these conversations about seeing what is possible and seeing what solutions are out there. Because the more we can see that, the better. We just need to get out of this current cycle of I don't know what to call it. It's not propaganda. It's just It's noise is what it is.
Yeah, and just to connect the dots to part of your work in The Hidden Power of Purpose, which we really recommend people to watch, you really talk about the science of what happens to us in terms of longevity and all kinds of benefits when we engage in a purpose outside of ourselves. So they've done research around social media and people who simply are spectators in social media. It gets them more depressed. But when they're engaged in doing something about an issue, social media actually increases our happiness and in all kinds of ways. And so just a little plug, as our listeners know, you know, one of our sponsors, the Elders Action Network, that really is about activating people over 55 to be engaged in issues of our time. If you're listening, get involved. Don't be a spectator to what's happening in the world and watch The Hidden Power of Purpose, and you'll see some quite poignant stories of people who took their own tragedies and turned them into a passion for issues that has not only helped the world, but changed their lives.
Yeah, and I think we get consumed by this kind of concept of purpose, and it seems a little lofty at times. And I think what the film does a good job of is introducing this concept that it doesn't need to be a big deal. Right? Like identifying what your purpose is can be a simpler path into it. And really just if we ask each other what we find meaningful, like if we kind of assess our day and think of the times when we felt engaged, that can have a huge impact on us. Who are we around? Who do we talk to? Who we leave a conversation with and think, oh, that was interesting, or didn't time go by so quickly? And maybe try and spend more time with that person. And I think it's those meaningful connections and engagements. Some people can confuse purpose with a pursuit of happiness as well. And it doesn't need to be a pursuit of happiness. It just needs to be a sense of engagement. And yeah, the film talks to all these different scientists and they cross the spectrum of their disciplines, everything from genomics experts that are looking at what's happening to the body on a genetic level through to behavioral psychologists and neurosurgeons, like brain surgeons like Dr. Sanjay Gupta. I mean, I didn't know until I did this project that he's still an active brain surgeon at Grady Memorial in Atlanta. So he's getting to look at brains on a very up close and personal level. And all these different people, cancer specialists, et cetera, they all say the same thing, that when someone's engaged in a purposeful way, what's happening to the body is that it's increasing the production of antibodies. It's decreasing the inflammation in your system so that you can be free to pursue that purpose or that goal or that North Star. And so in doing that, it's actually helping our body ward off different diseases and things. And it seems like hard to say it out loud that it's so significant, but all the science is pointing in the same direction from all these different disciplines, and the doctors are very metrics oriented. This is not just hypotheses or hyperbole. And on the social level, like you're saying around resilience, Dr. Anthony Burrow, who's up at Cornell, an incredible guy, but he does a lot of research in this about, like, if we're involved in a purpose, if we have a meaningful goal or something that we're engaged with, the likes and dislikes or followers or not followers that we're getting on social media doesn't really bother us as much. Our highs might not be as high, but our lows are definitely not as low. We have a more of a sense of resilience because we're on a trajectory. We're following something. We have our own security within us that is driving us towards something. And so we're less likely to be influenced by the yeses or noes of other people who come through our life on a transitory basis. And I think that's so important in today's climate. And so there's this, not to go on about it, but just Michelle Carlson, who runs the Brain Lab at Johns Hopkins University, said something to me that really encapsulates this whole thing, is that as a society and as a media center, we tend to talk a lot about diet and exercise, which are behaviors. So, oh, you want to live longer? You should diet this way, or you should exercise this way, right? And we don't spend enough time talking about the motivators, like purpose. Where do you find yourself feeling most engaged? What do you like to do most? With whom do you like spending time? Like, if we start looking at these things, these purposes that we have, these ways in which we might want to get further engaged, then what happens is once we define a purpose or think about these things and start getting out there, the behaviors take care of themselves. Because if we're on a purposeful track, we'll eat whenever we get the chance to eat, or we'll eat in that session while we're engaged with someone in a social way. We'll move and get up off the couch in order to go do that thing that we're finding purposeful. So we're much more likely to drive those behaviors if we're not directly addressing them, but we're addressing the motivators. And that differentiation between motivators and behaviors was so significant for me. It was really everything, because I think we don't ask each other, even though it's so important, we don't talk about, like, hey, John, what's your purpose? Like, we don't have those conversations. But maybe we should ask, hey, you know, what are you passionate about at the moment? When do you feel most engaged right now? Tell me about someone with whom you have an incredible connection. And I think just those ways, those paths into this topic can help us identify those things that make us just feel so rewarded and nourished, and things that we just want to do more of, and just lean into doing more of those things in whatever way you can. And that's going to increase your health, the health of the community around you. I just know it's going to have a measurable impact.
Yeah, I was moved personally by the stories that several elders in your film express at what change it meant for them. And when we know how much elders have been, or older people, I should say, have been marginalized and marginalized themselves, this is a very important dimension. So on another subject, we understand that you're working now on a project about hatred. Could you say a few words about that?
Yeah, it really is this kind of concept of tolerance that I've really started to focus in on. And of course, like, there are other projects that are going to come out first. We have a Black Girls film that is about to come out. It'll come out very, very soon. And so I'll keep you posted with links of where to find that. But there is this concept that I want to tackle. And part of it was at the beginning of COVID, I thought I was going to have a lot of time on my hands and I started reading some books. And then, of course, we figured out how to do production and very quickly and then became even more busy than we were pre-COVID. But I read a book called Confronting Hate about this guy, Rabbi Tenenbaum. And it was a really interesting thing. It was like, if I could kind of say who he was in a pop cultural way, it's almost like he was kind of like the Forrest Gump of interfaith. He just happened to be everywhere at all times. It's like he was at the Vatican when they were crafting an important message around tolerance. He was in Cambodia and Laos and those areas when there were a lot of boat people trying to escape their regions and ending up in the oceans, and he was physically there to pull them out alongside other celebrities and other political figures. He was important in introducing different faith leaders to Martin Luther King Jr. He had relationships with evangelical ministers and Greek Orthodox ministers. And I was just like, wow, this guy was really everywhere. And just the way that he confronted hate by having these kind of quiet conversations with other people from other disciplines of religion or other theologies just made me really consider a big project that I want to take on, which celebrates the younger generation of spiritual leaders who can motivate communities in a positive way. And I'll leave it at that for the moment, because there's a lot of kind of different angles that we're taking on it that I think are fairly original. But it's something that I really want to tackle this year, or start at least this year. And I'm really excited about it, but it's not going to be the most brand-backed project that I've done, most likely. It might have to be a personal one that I get across the line over the next couple of years.
Elliot, time always is our enemy here and our friend, so our time is almost up. We always like to end our conversations with our guests to ask them this question. How do you try to live personally a more regenerative life?
Yeah, it's a great question, because it can operate on so many levels. Like, even on the base level, clothes that I wear are literally from a company called Outer Known, which is Kelly Slater, the surfer's brand, and it's very sustainably driven. I suggest waiting for sales times to buy any of it, but you can do it. A few pieces can go a long way when you think about, like, just changing out the plastic of buttons for nut husks and things like that, and using modern regenerative cottons. The coffee in here is regenerative, from a company called Groundwork that have a regenerative coffee from Nicaragua. But of course, all that is kind of, you know, that's surface level stuff where you're just kind of putting your money where your mouth is. But on a deeper level, it's really about this idea of ideas plus empathy equal impact, right? It's like, if you can engage in a forward-driven way in conversations and projects that you feel are benefiting or contributing to a more just environment, then that is going to have a circular reflex, right? It's going to come back to you. And, you know, it's like instant karma. It really is as simple as that, I think, for me, is that the more you can do to feel a sense of abundance and not be so scared, be generous with your time, with your knowledge, allow people to have those conversations with you where you're not just telling them what to do, but maybe even just thinking through it together. But those conversations, those engagements, they're the things that are most generative and regenerative. And when you start introducing people to each other who you think should know each other, that to me is also a gift. I used to, because I just haven't found time for it, unfortunately, at the moment, but I want to get back to it. I used to try and end my day with an introduction So that even while the concept was that even while I was sleeping, other people were continuing to do good in the world or to further some issue or to just get to know each other on a social level, that that might create some sort of peace and harmony and goodness and impact. And the reason why I stopped doing it is because I started just falling asleep involuntarily, having a less structured end to my day. So maybe I need to get back to having a more structured end to my day and start to get back to just introducing people to each other. So just meaningful engagements, introducing people to each other, being a source of abundance as opposed to having that fear of scarcity. I think that's the way in which I try and approach this concept.
Well, Elliot, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for your emerging and beautiful body of work. Please, we'll have links to a lot of Elliot's work. We encourage you to watch it. And if you're a brand, he and I both work in the brand world. If you're a brand wanting to tell your story of good or the story of good, I'm sure many of you heard of the Aflac duck. Well, you know, this is a guy who's helped tell that story of how the Aflac duck has made a difference in the lives of children everywhere. So, Elliot, thanks for being in the studio with us today.
It was so nice to be with you both. And I appreciate the conversation. And it's been good to listen to some of the back episodes and hear you all work it out with your guests. It's an incredible topic of conversation and trying to craft this way forward. And to get meaningful engagement from across generations is vital. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Alon, any final word from you? And then I'll close this out.
I was touched by the going back and forth between your own story, your own experience, and what you are trying to promote and develop in the world. And that sense of, when you said the sense of abundance, the generosity, I think I really sense it in every word you say. And the sense of also contentment with what is. So, which is not antithetical to wanting to do better things. So thank you so much for your presence here.
Yeah, you know, years ago, Elliot, a Catholic nun named Jeanette Haas, she was probably 80 at the time. I was doing some work with the big Catholic healthcare system. And at the end of my 2-day retreat, people come out, it's a great job, you know, love your storytelling, et cetera. And Jeanette Haas, who I got to know pretty deeply over the next couple of years, simply came up to me and her only words were, John, thank you for accepting your calling. And I thought it was like such a great, she saw that, you know, I was living my purpose. So I want to say to you, Elliot, thanks for accepting your calling. As you said, you came to it slowly, as many of us do, to realize what our calling is. But clearly, that's what it is. You know, we talked about Joseph Campbell, who said that ultimately, most of us are not looking for meaning in life. What we're looking for is the experience of being fully human, which he called bliss. And one of my mentors said, you know, you're in your bliss when you lose track of time. And I feel you talked about that. And I feel Alon and Jim, when we're having these conversations with guests and talking about the way forward, I certainly lose track of time. And finally, thanks for reminding us that the best way to engage in the challenges of our time is to get involved in whatever way you want to get involved. I grew up in the church, and I always thought one of the best things Jesus ever said that has resonated for me, that's really not just a Christian idea, was, you know, he said, he or she who seeks to find themselves will lose themselves, but he or she who loses themselves will find themselves. In other words, when we lose ourselves in something bigger than ourselves, we suddenly find something deeper. So we hope you found something today of value to you. You're why we're here. Again, as we always say, if you love what you heard, please tell us and share it with others. If you think we could do better and like to hear some other topics, we'd love to hear from you. Meanwhile, as we always say on the way forward, history is not a place waiting for us to arrive each day for ourselves and for our communities. We are creating the history that will be told in the future. So for now, good day. Good day, mate, as the Australians would say, and we'll see you next time on The Way Forward. Thanks for joining us.
I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast, The Way Forward Regenerative Conversations. You have many choices, and we appreciate your interest and support. You can reach us at our email address, thewayforwardrc@gmail.com. Please share your thoughts and feedback with us. Only with your help can we make this a podcast you want to listen to and share with your friends. If you have guests you would like us to have a conversation with, please email us your recommendations. I would also like to thank our sponsor, Elders Action Network, who is building a movement of elders to address the environmental, governance, and social issues of our time. Their website is eldersaction.org. Until next time, I'm Jim Burke, and this is the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, which you can listen to on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Amazon Music. In parting, may I wish you a regenerative present and future.